The Geek Cave, brought to you by BuzzTime. Great minds drink alike. Shirtosaurus, digging up clothing from your past so you can look rad today. And GameStop, power to the players. Hey, nerds. We understand you. Drop those controllers, lose the wizard hat, and ready your Cheetos. It's time for some hard-hitting talk about the movies, books, and games you love. So get ready, oh searcher of useless knowledge. It's time to step into the Geek Cave. Now, broadcasting from a top secret and totally awesome hidden base, I'm Kent Harris, and here's Darren Wright, Justin White, and Chad Savage.
And welcome to the Geek Cave Podcast. I'm Darren.
I'm Justin.
I'm Chad, and we are brought to you by BuzzTime. Great minds drink alike. Shirtosaurus, digging up clothing from your past so you can look rad today. And GameStop, power to the players. We are talking movies and television. So let's start with, of course, what's the bad news? The writer's strike is probably going to happen.
God damn it.
So the Writers Guild of America with the American Motion Picture and Television Producers, I think is what it's called, or Association of Motion Picture and Television Producers, they're not coming to the table. And both of them are blaming the other side for not coming to the table. And they're both right. They both have proof of various points. So here's the gig. They're supposed to come, you know, negotiate, right? Mm-hmm. And the Writers Guild, they say, well, we got this voicemail message that says, don't bother coming to the, you know, don't bother coming tomorrow. And so they don't. Well, it's because the motion picture TV producers bit or whatnot, they're the ones who represent all the studios, mm-hmm. like 160 something studios, I think is what this one does. They had got an email saying that the Writers Guild were going to be having a meeting to make sure that they had the votes for a strike if they needed it. And so they were under the impression that they weren't going to be there anyway.
Oh.
And so it's just this cross-pollination of dumb where both sides aren't really coming through. They're blaming each other. Both sides are like, yeah, we'll come to the table. They just got to tell us when. And no one wants to blink first because, yeah, that would show weakness.
Of course.
So, silliness, ever silliness. So, in our world of reboots, remakes, and otherwise, Clue, which has been kind of in development hell, is getting its, you know, remake or whatnot. And after some lengthy discussions, apparently they're getting Rowan Atkinson to be Wadsworth. You know, what was funny to me, because Rowan Atkinson was in line to be one of the early in Wadsworth for the first one, and ultimately it went to Tim Curry, a very, very well done choice.
Oh, yeah.
Ultimately. But what's funny to me is that this is bringing together a whole bunch of Harry Potter alums, it seems, for this, where you have Daniel Radcliffe playing the new Professor Plum and Rupert Grint, who, Ron as Mr. Green. And then Tom Felton, who he's on The Flash now, but is coming in as Colonel Mustard. You know, so we've got all these kind of weird things. You know, the rumors right now are that they're trying to get Emma Watson and Ivana Lynch, you know, trying to get these other characters. The one that floored me was Maggie Smith. You know, Professor McGonagall herself supposed to be in this as the cook. the one who this upper crust, she's on Downton Abbey as, this regal woman is supposed to be the second victim?
With no lines.
Yes. It's like, what are you gonna tell me? It's like by the way, yeah, and now Sean Connery's coming out of retirement to be Mr. Body. I mean, this is just
Of course, we're assuming it's going to be a shot-for-shot remake of the original,
right,
where the cook has no lines.
Right. So, look forward to Hayley Atwell as the maid, I guess, next.
Oh, but, oh yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
Yes. We're all on board with
I'm
that.
I'm already looking forward to that.
So whatever next we get, it. I mean, at least we know that the actors can work together. So ABC is getting back into their reality show bits. I don't know if they're getting ready for the writer's strike.
Oh my God.
Or if this is just, you know, we don't have enough singing competitions. So you guys are aware of how the Monkees came to be, right? The band,
yes.
The Monkees.
Yes.
You know, it was a manufactured group.
To kind of give the American version of the Beatles.
Right. ABC's new reality show is called Boy Band, in which they're trying to assemble alums of boy bands to be architects, like that's the name that's going to be given them, that are going to effectively, through this competition, try to build the next Monkees. You know, it's going to be a manufactured group.
Oy.
Specifically to be a boy band, which will include a studio album deal. And I don't know what to say. I really hope that they get one of the guys from New Kids on the Block to be a judge, architect, sorry. You know, just because that to me would be funny as all get out.
What was great about the Monkees was they brought together two musicians, mm-hmm. and two actors. The actors didn't know how to play instruments, and the musicians didn't really know much about acting, but it somehow worked, and the show was enjoyable.
Uh-huh.
And when it came to music, especially when they all figured out how to actually play their instruments, it wasn't bad music, especially the stuff that they wrote on their own.
Right.
It somehow worked, and yet didn't at the same time.
Yeah.
This I don't see going as far as the Monkees did.
This is not going to go well.
This is
going to
last a season.
Hopefully. I don't know that I want to do more than that. So, well, before we get into reviews and impressions, Justin, did you have anything for movies, TV?
I don't.
Okay, Darren, did you have something for movies, TV?
Just one.
Just one.
And it's a pretty exciting thing.
All right, let me get my excited face on. Okay.
Whoa, tone it down, dude.
So this, at first time I read this online, I thought, okay, it's an early April Fool's joke, whatever. No, this is true. This has been verified by a couple of sources, and according to Variety, Batgirl is getting her own solo live-action movie in the DC Expanded Universe.
What?
That's not all. See, you remember when Joss Whedon was going to do Wonder Woman, but he ended up leaving because DC kept meddling and went to work for Marvel?
Yes.
Yeah, that went well.
And he did, yeah, well, he did the Marvel. First two Avengers movies. He did the first two Avenger movies, but then he left Marvel because of too much meddling. Sounds familiar. Well, now that Geoff Johns is in charge of creative at both the comic side and the movie side, he's pretty much trying to do more of a hands-off approach, letting directors kind of be themselves. Joss Whedon is going to direct Batgirl.
Well, if you want somebody with a proven track record of strong female characters, you can't really ask anyone better.
Yeah.
Yeah. John Berg is going to assist with director responsibilities. The project will be based off of Gail Simone's, or kind of inspired by Gail Simone's New 52 run on Batgirl.
I hope she's not involved in the writing, at
least the first volume of the New 52 run was pretty good.
I know, but some of her dialogue sucked. If she's listening, I apologize, but I don't.
Sorry, hashtag not sorry.
Sorry, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, there's no word on where in the timeline it takes place. DC, Variety does point out that DC is also working on a sequel to Suicide Squad, and Gotham City Sirens, which is a spinoff of Suicide Squad with Harley Quinn being the star of that. And so now we have the guy who... Now, there are some people complaining about Joss Whedon directing Batgirl because, and I'm not kidding, the biggest complaint is that he's not a woman. Never mind the fact that Whedon has directed female-oriented action shows such as Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Dollhouse, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., in addition to the two Avengers series. I think that it's a pretty good pick. We'll just have to wait and see. Doesn't look like they have a timeline for production as of yet, but it seems that this will take place at some point after Justice League.
Okay.
Well,
so there we go. Batgirl.
I do like Joss Whedon's style.
Yeah.
His directing style. I would like him to calm down a little bit on the fast cuts and some of the action pieces, but overall he does a very good job. And he does make sure that his female characters come out as not just strong, but capable.
Yes. Not just pretty, but pretty amazing.
Exactly.
There we go.
So, just a couple days ago from recording, we went ahead and put the trailer for the new It, Stephen King's It, on the cave. It looks suitably creepy. You know, I'm okay with the look. I like the look of that they did for Pennywise, you know, which was masterfully portrayed by Tim Curry in the TV movie, you know, miniseries. Mm-hmm. The only real great thing about that about that miniseries, and I liked it. They did a good job, and they did a good job in how they showed Pennywise, because it was up for just a very quick flash, like less than a tenth of a second. So you really had to be on the ball pausing in order to see it in detail. I'm a little concerned, though, because the movie that they're telling... So in the book, you get two stories in parallel, where you have basically this great evil. I mean, it doesn't have a name. That's the point of it. It's just evil personified, as it were, or given physical form. And so you've got the main characters as kids and then the main characters as adults. And the stories are told in parallel with each, as the book goes on, the parallels getting shorter. You know, where you go back and forth between the kids and adults faster and faster.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of, it was done purposefully, of course, to kind of show how these things progress, you know, how fear hits us as adults and as kids, and how as kids we might actually be better equipped to deal with unknown fear or fear of the unknown. The movie, though, is only telling the kids' side of the story. And telling only the kids' side of the story, it can certainly be interesting. It'd be creepy and spooky, especially if you have kids. I mean, it would be... Yeah. I mean, I think this will be terrifying, but I don't know that it's going to get across the full effect of the original story. That has me a little worried. There is supposedly a sequel in the work, you know, the rest of the tale, so to speak. It'll depend on how well this does, but since they're already crippling the story, I don't know if it'll do that well. Yeah. My earnest hope is that they would do this one, they do the sequel, and then for like a director's, you know, big cut kind of thing, they would recut the story to restore the parallel.
That would be nice. It
won't happen.
Yeah.
But it would be my earnest hope.
I could see why they're doing this, because it would take up... You'd have to basically make it a two-parter.
Easily,
if you're going to do the parallels. Because otherwise you've got like... 6-hour movie.
Yes. Or longer. Yeah.
Because, I mean, the miniseries itself...
Yeah, it was four hours long.
Yeah.
3.5-4 hours long. And, you know, it left out huge swaths...
Exactly.
...of the books.
And on a first... I mean, it's one thing to make, and I hate this, but to make your last movie in a series a two-parter, because you want to make sure you tie up all the loose ends or whatever.
Right.
This doesn't have a franchise per se. It's a standalone thing.
Yeah.
And so to make it part one and part two on a first release, only release kind of thing, that's not going to appeal to a lot of people.
Not too. So I don't know.
So I agree with you about the whole parallel thing, but I kind of get why they're doing it.
in this way, they can tell a story.
Yeah.
And I get that.
Yeah.
They're not telling half of a story. They're telling one complete arc.
Yes.
I get it. I guess I'm just a little bit of a purist, so.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
So, there's that. So, I watched Iron Fist. I'm sorry I didn't put a review on The Cave, but quite honestly, I just couldn't quite work up the energy to do it. I'm not getting paid, so I don't feel too bad about slacking off on
that. None
of
us are.
So, here's the bottom line. It is not as bad as the critics are saying. It really is not. But it's also not as good as the user ratings on Netflix or on Rotten Tomatoes or otherwise are saying. I would suggest the Iron Fist Netflix show, it's like watching a Batman series where you don't ever get to see Batman in the suit. You follow Bruce Wayne in his day life of running Wayne Enterprises and you know, going to board meetings and dealing with office politics and only occasionally stopping a mugger. That's how the first three-fourths of the show is.
Ugh.
And then the last three, four episodes, there's a lot. I mean, there's super heroics that are going on throughout the thing. But those last three episodes is really hard to get into because it's been such a slog to get to it that it's just, I wasn't sure it was going to be, the payoff was going to be worth it. Turns out it wasn't.
Oh.
And in what I consider a plot crime in anime is repeated here, where you finish the arc and then you have one more episode. That happens here. Basically, the show is over one episode early, and then they have one more episode to tie up their first season loose ends. And to leave the stinger for the Defenders.
Yeah.
I don't think the actors do a poor job. I really don't. I think that the characters themselves are boring. You know, the Danny Rand is a boring character. You know, early on, he is all optimism because he's young. You know, he's young. He's lived the last 15 of his years training and kind of having a purpose and knowing things. So he's optimistic, far more optimistic than Daredevil or Luke Cage or Jessica Jones, which could certainly add some levity to the Defenders. If it wasn't that they then spend the next 13 episodes making him dark and filling him with anger and bitterness and doubt. And it's just, we're going to get the death, death, evil, 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 evil songs of Defenders here with all the gritty that's kind of coming into this. Is it the weakest of them? Probably not. I would say probably Daredevil season 2, the non-Punisher stuff, was worse. You know, in terms of being slow and in Daredevil season 2, you know, Foggy knows who Matt is, and the Kingpin's out of the way, so they ought to be able to talk about these things and make it work, but they don't because Matt's an idiot. A smart idiot. And so it just kind of starts to fall apart, you know, because you don't believe the personality's in place anymore. Iron Fist is a bit like that. You know, you don't believe the personalities. On to happier things and more joyous things. So we got to see the Spider-Man Homecoming trailer. Did we get that on The Cave?
It's up.
Yeah.
It's up on The Cave. First impressions, there's a lot of Tony Stark in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I get the feeling that we know the plot is going to be get suit, lose suit, earn suit back. Does that sound pretty accurate to the trailer? I think that Tom Holland, right?
Yeah.
Because names sometimes escape me. I think Tom Holland is so far the most believable Peter Parker and Spider-Man that we've seen. I think Andrew Garfield made an amazing Spider-Man and a horrible Peter Parker. Tobey Maguire made a good Peter Parker and not a great Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Good for its time, not great.
Yeah.
Right.
Tom Holland seems to be the mashup of the best of both possible worlds. I will probably still see it. I like the hands that it's in this time, the movie that is. Yeah. And so I'm willing to go see it. You know, I'm as excited about this as I was for Spider-Man 1. And Spider-Man 1 is not the best of the Spider-Man, you know, that Spider-Man trilogy. Spider-Man 2 was the better one.
Yeah.
But we were still excited for that first Tobey Maguire Spider-Man.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm excited for this one. I'm hoping that there's a few surprises left in it. Because right now I feel like I could write the story that they're trying to tell, having not seen, like, I could do a Weird Al song parody, you know, that will tell the story of this Spider-Man movie.
Part of me wants to see a cameo between Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire sitting in a bar watching a newsreel of Spider-Man and making jokes about how silly the suit looks and how it should look more like the suits they wore.
I bet How It Should Have Ended will do something like
something
that.
Something like that, yes.
So from that trailer to the Justice League trailer.
Mm. Aquaman.
I was going to say, Aquaman, still a badass.
Yep.
I like that his armor is orange and green, but not Super Friends orange and green.
Yeah.
It looks like good ocean camo. I like that.
I dig it.
Aquaman, he also looks like he's the only one really having a lot of fun. and maybe because he's finally on land and, you know, his sinuses are clearing up. I don't know. There were a few things that I really appreciated about the trailer. First off, Wonder Woman is still amazing.
Yes.
You know, that is still... The Wonder Woman movie, I cannot wait more than I have to wait. I will want to see that on opening night. I won't get to, but I will want to. But I like the idea that it looks like the Flash, like, takes half a second to calm himself or to get into the Speed Force. Yeah, there, it's just a little half second kind of scene where before he takes off, it's like he does this, you know, clasps his hands together and like takes a deep breath and then
and he like goes meditative and
yeah. I kind of like the idea that maybe Barry has to connect to the Speed Force, you know, consciously in order to get into it. It's not something that he just does. Because I think that would lead to a stronger, faster Barry Allen. And, Aquaman, fun. Batman, not fun. Batman, dark. Although he does get one of the only jokes in the trailer. We get J.K. Simmons.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
J.K. Simmons as Commissioner Gordon. Good to see you working with somebody again. Maybe temporary.
After Aquaman comes in and makes a quip about, oh, you dress as a bat. Nice.
Bat. I like it. Maybe temporary. So, but we praise Geoff Johns a lot, and with good reason most of the time. I hope that he is not out of his element too much creatively to be able to bring these separate threads of the DC universe together. It looks good. I would say that this looks, it has the same look, which makes sense with Snyder at the helm. It has the same look as Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, which we liked. You know, we didn't have a problem with that movie outside of a couple of nitpicky kind of things. I hope that creatively Johns was able to put a little bit of himself into the story, that the story wasn't so set that all we're going to get is a couple of jokes and a couple of, you know,
yeah,
a couple of things. I hope that we see a little bit more of his personality thread through now.
That would be nice.
And that's what I got there and on that. So before I go into the random movie review, let's talk a little bit about our competition, you know, rather than right before the end.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So over the last three segments, we have intentionally lied to you, each of us once. Yes. We're recording on April Fool's Day, you know, and this seemed like as good a prank as any. Your job or your mission, or hell, you can just wait until next month and hear, is to figure out which of our stories was a lie. One for Justin, one for Darren, one for myself. There are times that we've certainly made up things, but those are pretty obvious.
Yeah.
These should be the things that weren't quite so obvious. There was a something in there. Let us know, what do you think, Darren, on Twitter or Facebook?
Either or. Just let us know with a comment or a mention on Twitter with the hashtag. With
hashtag spot the lie.
Yeah, hashtag spot the lie. And if you, depending on which segment you found the lie in, we'll determine what kind of prize you get. We have some digital movies that we want to give away. No spoilers on what they are. You'll be presented a choice. If you find the lie in the comic segment, you're the first one to let us know. You get something from Justin's Mystery Comic Stash, which, spoiler alert, has a lot of Batman in there. And
you say that like it's a bad thing.
No, we and say it like it's a bat thing.
Hey-o!
A bat. I like it.
And same for gaming.
What about games?
Same for gaming. You'll get a special little code either for PSN or Xbox Live or Steam if you do find the lie when it comes to, or Nintendo Network. We can send you a code for that as well, depending on your preference.
All right. So there we have it. Spot the lie. What did we lie about intentionally?
April Fool's Day.
April Fool's Day stuff.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Mm-hmm.
So, random movie review?
Kent?
And now, it's time for Chad Savage's random movie review.
Okay. So, for those of you who are loyal listeners, which I know most of you are, but if you're tuning in for the first time, willkommen, bienvenue, and welcome. And what I've been doing is reviewing a random movie from the American Film Institute's top 100 list of 2007, because that's their most recent top 100 list. I am sticking to movies that I've never seen before. Some of them are, they've just flown under my radar. Some of them are hard to find. Some of them I've just not gotten around to. This is one of them. So this month I watched The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman, Anne Bancroft, Catherine Ross, William Daniels, better known as the voice of Kit or Mr. Feeney, depending on if you were born in the 70s or the 80s,
mm-hmm.
and an uncredited Richard Dreyfuss, who Justin spotted in, what was it, 3 seconds?
Three, maybe four seconds.
His entire role was, do you want me to call the cops? I'll call the cops.
Yeah, that was it.
It's like, really?
Hey,
I'm the bad guy.
The fact that he had a line was impressive.
Yep, so it was. So The Graduate is basically the story of trying to decide what our main character wants of his life. Main character, Dustin Hoffman, at the age of 20, he's graduated from college with honors. He was a track star, etc. And he comes home to great fanfare by his family. And he's lost in trying to determine what his future is going to hold. He's got the expectations from his family and his family's friends and everyone else, but he doesn't know what he wants. And so in being nearly paralyzed by this indecision, he ends up in an affair with his father's partner's wife. Okay, business partner's wife. And like most affairs, it does not end well. He ends up chasing the daughter, and we get the famous scene of him interrupting a wedding and getting on the bus. So there's not really a lot of plot, because when you get down to it, it really is him trying to figure out what's next for me. And he's not very good at it. He is the Hamlet of of the movie. He is all thinking, no action. You know, he doesn't have a balance in any way. So getting into it, this movie, it's been put on the congressional archives for movies that have are considered culturally significant. It has been named, it was named twice to the AFI's top 100 list, the first time in 1998, the next time in 2007. And I don't get it. I don't get it this time. The last ones have all been good movies that I could say I understand. I get why this is considered a classic in the top of its game. This one, not so much. And it might be because it was 1967 when this was released, and the culture was just radically different. But here's where I think it was considered a classic, and here's where the problems are now. So in 1967, we had this big shift in the culture, especially from those graduating from college, who they didn't want to be part of the establishment anymore. They had all these expectations from their family. It's like, okay, so you went to college, which was not particularly, you know, well done.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot more skilled trades, a lot more factory work, a lot more manufacturing jobs. So going to college was a big deal, and graduating from college even more so. So you graduated from college, you have this great big bright, you know, successful future ahead of you. The establishment says, this is what you should do next. You know, now that you've gone to college, you either continue on to grad school or you go into business. You know, you get a job, you succeed. But the counterculture of the time was saying, I don't want to be part of the establishment. You know, you get kind of the hippie commune culture, the ones that say, I don't want to be part of that, man. I want to figure out a little bit more about who I am as a person and make my success that way. Why should I be trapped in some, you know, soul crushing, you know, future, enter into a loveless marriage, have kids that I barely take care of, and come home each night and drink bourbon because it's the only way to feel something. Which is exactly the situation that we find with Mr. and Mrs. Robinson. So the main character, Benjamin, played by Dustin Hoffman, he's caught in between that establishment. You know, this is what you're supposed to do. And the countercultural that says, I don't want to do this. And so on all sides of him, he is seeing his parents who are successful, you know, have a house, have an in-ground pool, have money, it seems, to spare. And he sees the Robinsons who also have money, have jobs, have security. And then Mrs. Robinson, who effectively gives him the choice of, do you want to have an affair with me or not? You know, because she knows who she is, but he comes to find out the life that she has, which is perfectly adult and establishment success. She's married somebody who's got money and power and stability. She's unhappy. She's an alcoholic. You know, she smokes all the time. She is a predator at best. Marked, oddly enough, she wears animal print in almost every shot she's in.
Yeah.
Except for the one where the affair is known. I don't know if you noticed that.
Oh, yeah.
And she's just wearing
all like black.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless she's a panther then. But anyway, not really a print, just a color.
Yeah.
But Benjamin is also just coming from college. And pretty much any college in the 60s, it was going to be the sense of, who are you now? You know, and who are you going to be? There still would have been a bit of that cult, that establishment, because you're being part of the establishment, going to college, etc. But the student population has never been as established as the establishment they attend. you know, you go to college, and there's always a little bit of the fight against what they represent. You know, oh geez, staid old buildings. Let's go do something.
Yeah.
Let's drink, smoke pot, listen to rock and roll, have premarital sex. That's what being college students is about. Or in my case, hey, let's drink beer and play D&D. Because I was one of the cool kids. Eventually, so Benjamin is spending his summer after graduation. His daytimes he's spending in the pool, you know, just soaking up the rays. And at night, he's carrying on this affair with Mrs. Robinson, And he's realizing that even in the midst of that affair, he's miserable. He's miserable because he doesn't know what he's going to do with his future. He's miserable because he can't connect to anybody. He's miserable because he's having an affair with a married woman who is old enough to be his mother, even though Anne Bancroft was only 6 years older than Dustin Hoffman at the time. So all this is nastiness. And then the two fathers start pushing him to take the Robinson's daughter out. And it's the one person that he forms any kind of connection with. The only person that he, because she's a contemporary, she's caught in the same spot, establishment or personal happiness. And that seems to be the real choice. Do I want to be happy or do I want to be successful? Like the two can't coincide. And because of that connection, he embarks on a long, creepy stalking phase that I think takes up most of the movie, at least two or three repetitions of Scarborough Fair.
Oh, God, yes.
Points for using Simon and Garfunkel in the soundtrack. I love Simon and Garfunkel. Points deducted for using the same three songs over and over again. Right? Sound of Silence, Scarborough Fair, April...
And Mrs. Robinson.
And Mrs. Robinson, which was written, I think, for the movie. And two versions of that. So take points away for that.
So they break even on the soundtrack.
Break even on the soundtrack. Eventually, what comes out is the affair gets known, and Benjamin, he's left desolate. You know, he no longer has the daughter that he's able to connect with because she assumes the worst out of him, mostly rightfully so. The husband finds out and is willing to try to arrest him and put him on charges. I don't know what for, because he hasn't committed a crime. You know, having an affair is not legally a crime. And so we get into this next phase of trying to chase down the daughter. The father takes the daughter and says, okay, now you're not going to college anymore. I'm pulling you out of that. You're going to get married to this other guy, you know, probably at the end of a shotgun. We're going to make you just like your mother, you know, successful, stable, a closet alcoholic. They don't say that, but that's kind of the implication of what's going to happen is, the daughter's going to end up exactly like her mother, you know, in this marriage because she has to be. Because in 1967, there was no recourse for divorce unless he was beating the snot out of her and could prove it. Or if he had an affair or she had an affair, then there are grounds for divorce. And the big scene then where Benjamin tracks her down, gets to the hospital after the fact.
Hospital?
Did I say hospital? Church?
Church.
Why did I think? I don't know why I thought hospital. I think because everything is black and white.
Yeah.
And the stark white, we'll get into that in just a second, the stark whiteness of everything just kind of reminds me of those, you know, institutional hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, gets to the church, bangs on the windows, calling out her name. She leaves her now, just got married husband in order to get on a bus where they have this great look, which might also be one of the best scenes in the movie. As they're riding away, they're riding on this high of, we're finally taking, you know, future into our own hands, and then having the now what face the face of, oh yeah, now we got to think about jobs and house and what this relationship's actually going to look like and do.
Yeah.
And then it's left ambivalent. We don't know their future unless you want to read the sequel book called Homeschool, which apparently only has tangential connection to the characterizations. The adult world is black and white. That's not saying that it was shot in black and white. It's saying that the houses, the insides are white, you know, and black. It is very stark. It's almost to show this kind of there's right and wrong, or there's good and bad. There is the establishment and there is not. Because when they go to, is it Berkeley?
Mm-hmm.
The college is colorful. When Benjamin and Elaine, the daughter, go on a date, they go to a burger joint. There's color. You know, even when they go to the strip club was almost all black with just little bits of white.
Yeah.
So places that are considered adult were boring, were monochromatic. And places that would have been considered kind of countercultural, very bright, vivid, you know, light. Makes me kind of wonder about that final shot, because the final shot is black and white. You know,
he's
wearing the white but torn jacket. She's in her wedding dress, yeah. White bus. You know,
everything was just kind of.
It's like that launch into adulthood for them suddenly made everything.
Even the bus was this pale yellow.
Yeah, like washed out. So long story short, and I realize this is way too late for that. Is it a good movie? No. Not really. There's nobody. Let me rephrase. If you were born, say, in the mid-50s, yes, this is probably a good movie for you. Because you'll remember kind of connecting with Benjamin. You would have been the same age at the same time. And so that feeling of, and knowing the culture intimately of established and anti-establishment. If you were born in the 80s, like we were, there's just not much to connect to. We can't connect to Benjamin not getting a job, you know, spending his summer in the pool and still somehow having money to get hotel rooms each night, you know, to carry on his affair. We can't connect to this desire to find yourself before ever doing anything else, because economically we just can't. You know, we're too old for that shit. Now, that being said, if you were born in the 90s, or we'll say mid-90s, and you're about 20-something years old, you know, and you watch this, you might connect again. You know, but for different reasons. You know, because now you can't get a job, there's no jobs, you know, you're economically in a kind of a funny place. But you're also in a position of trying to figure out who you are, what you're about, which is Ben's central problem. How you go about doing that, please try not to have an affair.
Yeah.
It didn't go well.
No.
And most of the time it doesn't. And even when it does, it still doesn't. So just give this one a pass. I can understand it in its importance as a cultural zeitgeist of something of a product of its time in 1967, I think this was a big deal. I think anybody who reviewed it in 67 who reviews it today, or, you know, for its 25th anniversary, it's 50 years old. So say for its 25th or 35th anniversary, if they reviewed it again, probably would not think the same.
Yeah.
Too much a product of its time doesn't deserve to be on the AFI top 100. Anymore, unless the top 100 for AFI is only being populated by people who are born in the 50s,
which is entirely possible.
It is possible.
The only reason you, in my opinion, should sit down and watch this movie, mm-hmm. other than just sheer curiosity,
right,
is if you're studying film, because there,
yes,
there were a lot of deliberate shots and scenes in this movie.
Every shot has some meaning.
Yeah.
From from the look on his face on the plane as he's coming home in the very opening shots,
uh-huh.
you know, of the board disaffected, to the point where he's at the party in his honor, and the shot is him right in front of his fish tank, so it looks like he's underwater. He's already drowning before he's ever had to do anything.
And, you know, it's like the fish tank had the only spot of color in the house.
Right.
One little thing in his room.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, from a technical standpoint, from a film buff standpoint, yeah. it's worth watching.
Yeah, a technical or a historical standpoint, yeah. I'd say it's appropriate. And if you want to, because the people who are making films now watched it and were impacted, influenced by it. So you'll see certain shots and techniques used that are reused. So, you know, using color, using angles and so forth. And it's been endlessly parodied. The bus, the looking at Benjamin under the legs of Mrs. Robinson. You know, these are things that we see over and over again. And so there's that if you want to watch it. But otherwise, you don't really need it. It is a very long hour and 45-minute movie.
Yeah.
And your time could be better spent elsewhere. You know, watch Sing. You know, the animated animals reality voice contest. It's just as good, but it's brighter and funnier. Don't be like me. Don't be like us.
Yeah, apparently, yeah.
Wow, all right.
Unless you're a film student.
Unless you're a film student, yes.
So that's what I have, and these two guys didn't seem to have anything else. Don't forget, hashtag spot the lie. Yep. Let us know what we were lying to you about in each of the three segments. Get fabulous prizes. We're brought to you by BuzzTime, Shirtosaurus, and GameStop. For the unimitatable Kent Harris, for Darren, Justin, and myself, thank you for joining us. Everyone is a geek for something.